time to thrive. Welcome to the Thriveology Podcast with Dr. Lee Bockham. Join us as we explore ways that you can thrive in your life, regardless of what life throws at you. It's your life. Time to live it.
We all know what's in there. It's our true self, our truest self, that deep part of ourselves that really is the key to us living a full life. But how do you get there? How do you dig down to that true self? Well, today I have the opportunity of talking with Dr. Avis Attaway, who is a speaker, an author, and a performance success strategist who has helped thousands of people reach their goals in business and in life. She's the author of the book, The Image Maker, which is about transforming your life from the inside out. She's had a thriving practice as a marriage and family therapist for over 25 years. In 2008, she founded and became the executive director of a nonprofit therapist training center, which offers affordable counseling to her community. Understanding the blocks to success and how people can permanently change at the deepest levels has been a driving force in Avis's career and life. Her expertise in human behavior and motivation is rooted in her many thousands of hours spent helping clients and informed by her doctorate in clinical psychology. She is also trained in hypnotherapy and other healing energy modalities, and also has a mission to help individuals achieve freedom from their self-imposed limitations and to discover their core self so that they can live out their true purpose and potential. So join me now as I interview Avis Attaway. Avis, thank you so much for being here. I'm excited to talk with you about how we deal with this inner stuff. But before we talk about that, the gunk, as you might say, let's talk a little bit about how you got to here. And usually that has an intersection. You know, if people are talking about how they move through life and how they help people do that, it's usually because they've gone there yourself. And so I'm curious, how did you get to this place? Can you tell us a little bit about your story?
Yes, thanks, Lee. Yeah, I always say that, you know, you can't take somebody any place you haven't gone yourself. And I feel like I had a period of a time in my life almost 30 years ago in which it just everything, it was like the perfect storm. Everything just seemed to sort of crash together. At that time, my sister, who was 13 years older than me, and sort of like a mother figure, second mother figure to me, was diagnosed with brain cancer. And at the exact same time, my marriage was coming to an end after 12 years, and we were preparing to separate and divorce. And we lost our home at that time. And we had two dogs, one young, one old. Both of them died. And a year, about a year after my sister eventually died, and then the same week she died, my aunt died. A few months later, a couple of co-workers were actually murdered, and my father died 1 year after she died, and my mother-in-law died. And I just really felt like I could not breathe, and I was just so suffocating with the weight, the grief, and all of it. And it led me into therapy. I found myself, it was a small thing, Lee. I was denied a promotion that would have allowed me to save my home. And it was just that just kind of pushed me over the edge. And I found myself, literally found myself hitting my head against a wall and just thought, okay, I need some help. I need some professional help. And that's when everything changed.
So everything changing, let's talk, I mean, that's a whole lot of loss, and not just loss, but loss of support, loss of hopes and dreams.
Oh, yeah.
Companionship, yeah. All of those pieces.
Yes. So yes.
You said the last straw was that piece. Last straw doesn't mean that was the main thing. That's just the last.
Yeah. Yeah. That was the thing that just pushed me into taking some kind of action. I wasn't going to be able to do this by myself.
And this was all at the same time you were working towards being a licensed therapist, correct?
Yes. Yes. I was in school. It was like I started school somewhere in the middle of all of that. And so I was raw. I was wide open. And I was doing my therapy. I did about a year and a half of therapy. And I found someone to work with that. She works differently than I do, but she led me into the most profound healing, because what I discovered underneath everything was me. And I mean, in the beginning, like the first almost year, all I could do was cry. She was about 45 minutes away, and so I had a commute, and I would cry all the way there, and then I would cry all the way through session, and then I'd cry all the way home. And I consider this a turning point. The most profound thing that she said to me, doesn't maybe sound that profound to somebody else, but when I told her about all my crying, and I said, when will I be done crying? And she said, you'll be done crying when you're all done crying. And that was just so powerful to me, because I just felt like I just had to like move through this thing. Let's get on with this thing, which, you know, maybe that's the American way. It was certainly the way I had been living my life. And just let's just put a happy face on this thing. Let's just like find the positive and move on. And I was denying myself the reality of the rest of who I am, this, you know, living, feeling, sentient being that's capable of deep grief and rage and terror and all of them. And she gave me permission to just be in it.
One of those things that I think it is a wherever it comes from in our culture about grief is that there's a certain time frame. And you know, people always ask you, I've heard 6 months, or I've heard a year, or whatever it is. And what she was pointing to is the fact that grief takes as long as grief takes. And we can, you know, we can make it last longer, but we don't do good when we take shortcuts. So that process of grief, you discovered something underneath it. And I like that you said, I discovered underneath everything was me. So
yeah,
I'm curious what that means. What does it mean that you, me, was underneath it?
It was this sense of being. This sense of being that precedes everything. It's what really undergirds our mindset. For me, it was just to be me without any thoughts about what that looked like from the outside. I realized that I was looking a lot at myself from the outside, which also was really crippling and really slowing me down. And concerning myself with how things might appear, what I ought to be doing, just all those layers of conditioning and shoulds, that when I got underneath it and just took that permission and just gave myself permission to just be in that state that I was in the moment that I was in it, it's like something broke open, and I was able to like step into this bigger space, just like this clear space where I could hear me and feel me, and aside from anything or anybody else.
That looking at yourself from the outside, in other words, looking at yourself on how you imagine other people are viewing you, how you imagine you're being perceived. Some would call that ego. Is that the kind of the same term you would use for that?
Yeah, I would. Yeah. I mean, that's that part of us that is, you know, going to make sure that we don't get run over by a bus, right? I mean, you know, it's the part that keeps us moving in life. It wants us to be unique. It wants us to be that individual. It wants us to be special. And it doesn't really take into consideration the deeper stuff, the feeling stuff. It's conditioned. I think our egos are conditioned by our conditioning. I mean, everything that we learn from, I believe, in the womb, we're hearing messages, but certainly from the point of birth on, all those neural connections that get made, like by the time we're three, there's twice as many neural connections in our brain as there will be when we turn 21. So we're just learning everything, and then later we start pruning that stuff away.
Yeah, getting rid of whatever was taking up too much energy and not enough benefit.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. So the ego, for me, I see this tension with the ego of wanting us to be individual and wanting us to be unique and wanting us to not stand out. You know, that there's a tension there of both of those. How are people thinking about me? Oh, are they thinking I'm strange? Versus, oh, I hope they see how unique I am and special I am. And that part of the battle is in that. Is that
No wonder Americans, like, we have 40 million Americans afflicted with anxiety. I mean, you just described it, right? I need to be special and I need to stand out and I want everybody to notice me, but I want everybody to love me too. I need to be accepted. I need to belong. I mean, our need for belonging and significance, they're coupled. We need them both. And what I've learned through my own journey and also through working with many clients, thousands of hours of therapy with clients, is that when we have this experience from the earliest time of our life that we're significant, that when we internalize a secure experience as a very, very, very young child, and we know that we're loved just for who we are, not every moment of the day, but good enough. When we get that good enough experience of mattering to somebody, then we internalize that. And when we internalize that, we have an internal secure attachment. We go out into the world with that. We're able to show up in life, in business, in school, in our relationships from that secure place of, yeah, I know who I am.
So the secure place, is that the me you talked about of being underneath?
Yeah. Yes. Yes.
How do we get through that? How do we get through the junk?
Well, you know, I believe, and what I've, don't just believe it. I mean, I know it because I, when I work with people, what I see is that this stuff just shows up every day, and it shows up in the what you might consider to be like the minor things, the little things that happen that just plug us in. And they don't just plug us in like, oh God, that's annoying. But it plugs us in like, gosh, I think my reaction to this is kind of out of proportion to what's really happening here. You know, and I look at that as having some kind of a root then, an ancient root. That, and that actually taking that feeling in that moment, you know, under the right circumstances, you have to be relaxed enough, but you can, under the right circumstances, you can just use that, I call it the portal to pain. You can actually just take that and make a direct connection to where, when you first felt that way.
Okay. So let's talk a little bit. You're in your story, you have all of this stack of losses. Mm-hmm. And the majority of those losses you had nothing to do with.
Right.
And some of those you were only partly to do with. In fact, the only one I can look on this list, you had something partly to do with the fact that there was your job that you were trying to, you know, get to a promotion. And then in your marriage, there you were also a part of that relationship. Other than that, everything happened regardless. It happened just because life.
Yeah, life happens, yeah.
So how does that fit into all of this? How does that fit into how that junk gets in our way?
Well, you know, it isn't, you know, that's, you know, that saying, Lee, it's not what happens to you, it's what you do with what happens to you. So life happens, and we have these experiences, and every experience is a learning experience, no matter what our age is. But when we're, but at a certain point, then we are just defaulting to an old pattern, an old way of responding. And when we encounter a situation and it seems to create this response or trigger us, or I call it activate some part of us that's out of proportion to the event, then that is pointing to that same feeling having occurred a long time ago and having set you up for a strong, overwhelming response subsequently. So every time you get that same icky feeling, you're like, you're really like shot back to that first time, and really like your response is going to often be very much along the lines of whatever age you were at that time. So I mean, I've had private clients say to me, oh my God, I've had a 3-year-old running my life in that area. And because that's the feeling, that it got frozen in the nervous system at some young age, and whatever age you were, that's the intensity and the nature of your response. I mean, like 3-year-old's tantrum, right? Lots of adults tantrum. We know this.
So is it fair to say that you have, you've created coping strategies from way back that no longer necessarily get the results they did back then, even if back then they didn't get what you wanted, they at least had a result. And that's how we deal with what life throws our way.
Yes, I think that's perfectly said. Exactly. Even though that response no longer serves us, I mean, it's probably hindering us, but it's unconscious. And this is where, you know, Carl Jung talked about making the unconscious conscious, mm-hmm. because otherwise it's going to operate and direct your life from the shadows. And you're going to feel like life is, these terrible things are happening to you, when in fact you're really attracting situations, certain people. You're really creating your life from that place. But when you bring this stuff to the surface, then you can respond instead of react. And so what previously perhaps caused this huge reaction from you, you know, which might be like an overt behavior, or it might be a shutting down. But when that happens, you're really out of control and you're just kind of watching yourself. And later it's just like, dang.
The old loop is playing. The old program in your head is playing.
Yep. Yeah.
So that's both in behavior, and as I've witnessed it, also in our interpretation mm-hmm. of what's going on. So
Oh, sure. Everything has to pass through that filter, doesn't it?
Yeah. I remember I had a client who came in, and he told me about how his wife was leaving him, and how horrible she was, and how his partner was cheating him out of everything, and how his customers were robbing him blind, and how his broker was taking advantage of him, and how his lawyer wasn't protecting him, and his CPA was taking advantage of him. And I stopped him and I said, you know, there's one common theme about that. He said, I know, the world is out to cheat you. I said, no. It's you.
Yeah, the common denominator.
And all of that.
Right. Yep. You're the common denominator. Everywhere you go, you're showing up.
And we have that experience where we find ourselves repeating these patterns. So most people at least have glimpses of that. Mm-hmm. What's the first step in kind of moving through that?
First step is really kind of identifying, like, in what ways your life is being negatively impacted. Like, what are your top three limiting beliefs say? So you start with some little bit of exploration to discover those pieces. And then you move into, so I call that, I say there's like three stages. This is like my beta program that's going to be coming out pretty soon. Three steps to having the life you want. There's a little shameless plug. I say there's three steps. And the first one is that self-awareness. So just becoming aware of what needs to be changed, getting that stuff identified for yourself. So that's a relatively short, you know, a quick step. The second step would be self-mastery. So, and the mastery comes from actually taking that deep dive to reveal what's underneath these limiting beliefs. And then, just to use some fun verbs, excavating that. So getting in there. And excavating what's no longer serving you. And that kind of at the same time, what that does is it discharges the pressure. And literally what you've got is like frozen neural patterns, or, you know, frozen patterns in your nervous system that they're unfinished feelings. They really, in essence, what we're dealing with is feelings that got shut off at a very early age because they were just too overwhelming and felt like they could kill you because you were just a little person and you couldn't deal with it. And at that moment, weren't getting the support to help you. And so it just gets frozen in there. And so it's just a neural pattern. And coming back to the ego, you know, this is all about survival stuff. So those frozen responses in there were really out of survival at that time. And, you know, your system just wants you to survive. So then here it comes again the next time you feel that way. But when that feeling, which is the messaging system to, well, now you need to run, or now you need to fight, or now you need to hide. When this message is allowed to completely be delivered, in other words, felt, when you've just finished the feeling, let it run itself out, it's done. I mean, that's the discharge, and it's gone. And just kind of leaves this space behind. And in that space, then you can discover what's your new truth. And then that, to me, that's where we're getting into the third stage of self-expression. Now with that new truth about your story, you can build on that and apply that to your life.
Okay, so let's go up to self-awareness being the place where you think, because you talked about these limiting beliefs, and mm-hmm. you know, there while that might not take long, there is a step that requires people to recognize that we all are seeing things, you know, only partially, that we all have paradigms or limiting beliefs that color everything we see, that
right
allow us to see patterns that aren't necessarily there. I mean, that is one of the human conditions, that we see patterns mm-hmm. and somebody a bunch of numbers and they'll tell you what the pattern is, even if they're random numbers. Mm-hmm. And we do that everywhere in how people behave around us. And so that first step is somehow shifting to say, okay, I'm not seeing everything for what it is, but how I believe it to be.
Yes. Yes. And, you know, when I talk about the beliefs, I'm sort of taking a shortcut here, because what I really, really believe is that, you know, anything that we're thinking is really the, okay, I have to back up here. We have certain things, lots of things that we just believe because we thought it and it worked in that moment. And then we just marry it. And so that's just, we don't want to have to think about that again. But a lot of things that we believe that really don't make any sense are driven by an emotion or a feeling. And we don't really, I believe that, and I know, you know, you're a therapist too, and so you know there's always that long-standing argument, is it, you know, beliefs before feelings, or feelings, which comes first? Is it the emotional part or the thinking part? But I always go back to the infants, don't really, they're pre-verbal, and so they don't have organized thought yet, but they have feelings. And I've worked with so many people, you know, from, you know, ages, even in utero stuff, but like infancy, toddlerhood, pre-verbal stuff, where they're able to identify now, because they have language now, what those original feelings were. And those beliefs come out of what you've been feeling. And if there's a trauma, Dr. Frank Corrigan outlined a pathway in trauma, that there's three levels in trauma, which has always been my specialty, trauma. And the pathway is, one of the pathways involves that the autonomic nervous system, where you have a profound feeling in the periaqueductal gray. I'm not going to get too sciencey here, but that part of the brain where the emotions are held, whether they're the terror, rage, grief, shame, those really profoundly overwhelming feelings are on one aspect of that part of the brain. And then on the other is love and nurturing and care and playfulness and sexual desire. When you have a profoundly traumatic feeling, and it's overwhelming, you know, it sets off the whole autonomic nervous system and goes down and creates all the reactions inside all of your organs, and, you know, getting you ready to run or to fight, or, you know, shuttling blood where it needs to go and slowing down digestion and all of that business. And then it travels up into the parts of the brain that have body awareness, the basal ganglia, and you're noticing. And this all happens so fast, it's almost simultaneously, but you're noticing what's happening in your body. And then that goes up into the beginning of thinking about what's happening in your body, and then moves over into your prefrontal cortex in terms of like making a decision about what your situation is. And those decisions, when you're very, very young and it's a traumatic event, will turn into what I call survival beliefs, survival beliefs, or core beliefs, such as I'm going to die, I'm unlovable, my mind's blanking, I'm going to die, I'm unlovable, I'm defective, and I'm invisible. And so then that evokes a feeling. So now there's another part of the system that comes online, and that's the part that is involved with the release of the neurohormones. So you're either going to have those hormones that, you know, dynorphins and corticotropins that make you feel like alone and isolated and scared and shut down, or in the good feelings, when you bring the good feelings online, those are all, that's like your oxytocin and your mu opioids, and you get that warm, cozy, warm, fuzzy feeling, wrapped in love, I feel all good. And so you have these other two systems that are running also. And the initial system, the third one is the initial one, that's the amygdala that recognizes danger. So when you've got, you know, a pattern from being 3 years old, anything can set the amygdala off. If it looks vaguely similar, your system is going to try to keep you alive. It just wants you to survive, right? Not thrive, just survive. And it just becomes all about that. And people get locked into that. And, you know, the Kaiser Foundation did that study. I'm sure you're familiar with it. And they came out with that adverse childhood experiences test, the ACE test. It's just super simple, 10 questions. And just like nobody gets through this life unscathed. Nobody gets through childhood unscathed. You're going to have your feelings hurt. You're going to, you know, be living with situations where parents are, maybe one is drinking too much, or, you know, or one's depressed. You know, maybe if your mother was depressed, it's no fault on her, but you still quite possibly, quite likely did not get your needs met. So there are these instances in your life when you're overwhelmed and you're a little person and the stuff freezes. And then that's what's running later in life.
And part of all of the, I mean, you said it yourself that the our base level of survival, I always talk about survival is the automatic. Yep. And if we're going to get above automatic, we have to switch off from the allowing it to be automatic. We have to make some choices. We have to get through the junk. And so
exactly,
that's the pattern you're talking about. When all of these, it's not like you can unhook the amygdala or the autonomic system, right? I mean, those are hardwired in, and they are there for a reason.
Yep.
And they create, and part of it is our brain is hijacked into believing that it really is about survival. So when the coworker is saying something in a loud voice, or somebody cuts you off on the highway, or somebody takes the last loaf of bread at the store, that the response to that feels like it's about survival.
Yep.
When in reality, it's not.
Yep. Those are perfect examples of when your reaction is out of proportion to the incident, right? I mean, somebody takes the last piece of bread. And for some people who maybe, you know, were, did not, you know, I talk a lot with my clients and teach them about, it isn't just what happened to you when you were a kid or in any time in your life, but it's what, especially as a young child, it's what didn't happen that should have happened that really sets you up for, it's a hard one to just do typical therapy with because you can't really point to it. You can't point to what didn't happen. But when an individual is able to step back into the remembering, they will remember what they didn't get. And that allows that to complete. And so the idea that we're, I'm sorry. I lost my train of thought.
Let me ask you a question then to bring us back on a train.
Okay.
How might one point to some of their own limiting beliefs?
Well, you know, that's what I was referencing before, is it's creating pain in your life, you know, in some way or another. You know, maybe it's showing up in your relationship as you know that you have an issue with trust. I mean, that's not that uncommon. Or maybe it's in business. You're just simply doing things, but then you don't follow through with it. And, you know, you're kind of like doing these self-sabotaging behaviors because, see, I would see that then as evidence that the individual has some fear that they're either unlovable or they're defective. And so that's a truth to them. And so their life just aligns with their truth, not that they like it. So when people talk about what they're struggling with, then we'll talk for a bit about those survival truths and take a look at what resonates for them. And that begins to point us in direction. But honestly, Lee, it's like the same for everybody. It's just a matter of discovering what their own unique personal experience was that just comes back up and online whenever they feel this way and they don't like it. It's going to always go back to something that happened. And when you get access to that thing, and it's just like connecting the dots. So, you know, when the person says, and they cut me off, that guy cut me off on the freeway, and sometimes they come into session and they're still kind of raging because this guy cut them off. And for them, it feels like people don't see me. Maybe he has the I'm invisible thing going on. People don't respect me because I'm defective or I'm unlovable. But it always is pointing back to some belief about self, and then the rage or the depression or whatever the response is just that individual's way of dealing with it, which, you know, why do some respond this way and that way? I don't know that answer.
Okay. So the patterns are around you. I've got three listed here, and you said some others: I'm going to die, the feeling I'm going to die.
Yeah.
The feeling I'm invisible.
Right.
The feeling I'm a defective.
Yep.
There was something else.
I'm unlovable.
Unlovable.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, you know, children blame themselves. We really come into this world actually quite accountable and responsible, because little kids, when things are going wrong or going bad, they'll say, it's my fault. Daddy left mommy, and it's, you know, because I didn't clean my room. And of course, you know, we know as adults that's ridiculous, and you try to assure the child that's not the case, but that's what we do. And when we don't get our needs met, we blame ourselves as a little child. Well, you know, because I must be really unlovable, or I must be defective. And this is where what I call the compensatory behavior comes in. So that's sort of like the birth of whatever it is that person, and that includes all of us, decided to do to overcome that. Well, if it's my fault, then that must mean that I could do something about it. And so whatever is sort of probably in keeping with the circumstances and the child's, you know, inherent, you know, traits and disposition, that child might become like the superstar athlete of the family to try and, you know, get, you know, to get the attention, or maybe just something more interpersonal, become a people pleaser. I'll take care of everybody around me so that mommy and daddy are happy, and then, maybe then, they'll turn and they'll see me and I'll get the love I need. And then we carry that through life, and that's how we operate in the world, people pleasing everywhere we go, or trying to be the best all the time, the best everywhere we go, because really we're just trying to get that earliest need met, and it doesn't work in adulthood. It you know, there's no way it can work, because it never answers that child part's need.
I've always talked about these three fears that we have, which are kind of like these limiting beliefs that we believe we won't have enough, we won't be good enough, and we won't be loved enough. And those to the same pieces, yeah. You know, and that those are what we react to when we feel like we're not going to have enough. Mm-hmm. We react to that. When we feel like we're not good enough, we react to that. When we feel like we're not loved enough, we react to that in a way that is either to get away from it or to chase after it.
Yeah, right, right, right. And whether or not that creates that fight or flight in us, are we a fighter? Are we going to get mad? You know, or are we going to shut down or pull away or hide? You know, like you say, that's just particular to the individual.
Okay, so that is the piece that pulls us into self-awareness, that we're aware that what's going on isn't working, and begin to be aware of some of the pieces that might be contributing to that.
Exactly.
So how do we then move into could be painful, excavating piece of the self-mastery?
Well, you know, it's a lot simpler than you think. That when we are relaxed enough, and you know, I teach, you know, breathing, and I do guided visualizations, and we bring the body in. The body is a huge part of all of this. So noticing what's happening in your body when you're having this emotional feeling, is another huge part of it. And creating enough of a feeling of safety in the brain and in the body that the individual then can, circle back around, and let's look at that thing we were talking about that was distressful to you. And revisit it now from this place of safety. And there's a components to it that creates a nice holding so that the individual is able to stay and to tolerate new feelings. new to them, the old feelings, as those come up. This stuff will bubble up just automatically because just like our body is built to heal, so is our psyche. So if you create the right conditions, this stuff will just bubble up because it knows that it needs to be expunged, it needs to be discharged. And so it's relatively simple to help the individual in a very relaxed state identify the first time they ever felt that way. And the answer is never wrong. And there could be, an answer. There could be a second answer that also supports the first answer, but the individual will tell you how old and they'll tell you. I mean, that's ego state work. That is that part of you that had a profound experience that just gets recorded at the age at which it happened. So, if it's 2 years old, 3 years old, and I sort of coach my clients, don't edit it. If you get something and you think to yourself, that's crazy, 6 months old, that's ridiculous. just play with it. Just go with it anyway. And because I had my own experience, which led me into this work, and I was in the crib. I was able to stand, but it, and it's possible to remember because all the cells that were there and present, in your infancy are still present. Well, this is probably, the nth generation of them, but, the data gets passed along. The data gets passed along and the memories are held in the organs, all the organs of our body. So it's not just stuff that's like located up here in our head. So getting relaxed enough allows the person to just connect with the feeling of when it first happened, and then just holding the space for the person to remain in that relaxed state, which allows them to tolerate the whole memory. And what happens is they'll remember things that they always knew because that's, just your prefrontal cortex, but they're relaxed enough that they can start to work from another part of the brain and the subconscious, which is actually in your subcortex. And that's the body part. So it's just really relaxing the body enough to just feel what's coming up and just allow that and just allow it to just bubble to the surface and just kind of follow it like you're just, looking out the window of a train and scenery is flying by. And then there'll be something that will have an emotional component and just staying with that and just allowing the whole emotion to come. So a lot of this at this point then is just me holding space and just coaching them to just allow the stuff to just finish, just allow that to finish. And then what always happens is this relief that comes after the release. And then we as we bring things to a close, we look at, and this is the simplified version, right? But it's really not much more complicated. I'm just not giving you the detailed steps. But, we end with, wrapping it up, in terms of what do you think now? Because I want to bring that thinking back online. We've been dealing with the body and all those emotions. And now what's true for you, especially as you think about that. And then that, so then that's the, that's what leads us into that third stage of the work, where now you can begin to express from actually this new truth. You've made a connection with, your core self, because every time you peel back a layer like that, you really are, just creating all this, energy that's now available to live and create and be productive instead of holding all this stuff down. And you're lightening the load, and more you're feeling who you are really, truly at the bottom of everything. When you have that experience and you survive it, like those feelings you thought would kill you, and now you survived it. You have this experience of there's this me that's just constant through the whole thing. And I'm always there. The me is always there. And I can travel without all these layers of junk that's been pressing me down all this time. And so it's not a conscious decision. I mean, this is a physical release and a psychological release. And so you just catch yourself acting differently after that. You don't even have to remember to be, calm or remember to be assertive. You just, wow, look at that. I responded. That's different than how I would have responded in the past.
So you talked about the junk holding you down, but Would it be fair to say that the energy is in you holding the junk down?
Absolutely. No, that's actually correct. Thank you.
You're putting the boards down and nailing them on a regular basis and running around and continuing to nail and putty off and put the sandbags down and doing everything to keep it all in there.
Yep. That's exactly right. We spend an enormous amount of energy doing that.
Terrified that it's going to do damage when it comes out, only to have it go away.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. The thing you feared all this time, then it just like turns out to be, I mean, something that you in fact can survive. You can, no feelings ever killed anybody. Not when they felt them. Mm-hmm. I think that like, you know, like that ACE report, we found out that actually long-term, if you don't ever feel them, actually they can make you sick and possibly kill you.
Yeah. No feelings that are processed are going to kill you, but
that's right.
They can do a lot of damage while we're holding them down and keeping them stuck.
Exactly.
So there is that middle step. You talked about that step two, as there are a lot of details to it. So we talked about step one, which is recognizing that this is going on. We touched on step two. That's the more technical, more who's going to help you with that process. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about, but why would you do that? Which is step three. What does that allow in life?
Well, what that allows is for you to begin to just flow, you know, so actions that before were a struggle, like, you know, I really need to do this, you know, whether it's, you know, I really ought to be exercising, you know, I've got to do something about my donut roll, or if you're, you know, knowing that you need to be making sales calls and you can't make yourself do it, or all of that stuff now begins to flow more easily. You find yourself doing these things without all all those conversations in your head, all those arguments. You also have more of that energy we just discussed, because now you're not battening down the hatches and you actually are able to begin to express. So you're more motivated. You're more inspired. You find yourself, you know, actually able like to get into the zone, because when you're not like constantly dealing with a feeling of being in survival or worrying about how life is happening, you can flow more spontaneously. And by being in the zone, you can actually get, you know, inspired. And these things begin to materialize because you're not getting in your own way. That's sort of the subtitle of my program, is, you know, getting out of your own way. Mm. Because that's really what we've been talking about. And when you get out of your own way, then things start to happen. And then you start to have some confidence that things are going to happen. And dreams actually start to materialize. And then so you make your dreams a little bit bigger. And, you know, life just gets more fulfilling.
So when I talked about my colleague or my client that all this was happening to him, and you know, when he finally started realizing that it was him as the common denominator, that raised the question. He said, "So what are you telling me? It's my fault?" And I said, "Well, you may want to notice that you're either bringing people in that will do that, or you're creating the perception that that's how you're reading it, right? You're either perceiving it as happening, or you're bringing in people that will do it to you.
Right.
That's still coming from somewhere within you. It's not your fault. It is your responsibility.
Right. That's right. That's right. And you know, I've heard that from clients. Sure. So you're saying it's my fault. Well, you know, it's semantics. I mean, let's just say that you're at the cause of it. I mean, isn't that good news? Because as soon as you get past the sting of, what, this is my fault? Why would I do that? You get the rest of it, which is, well, then if it's my fault, that means that I can change it. That I have the control. I'm no longer a victim. I mean, isn't that better than being, you know, a victim of the world, or at the effect of other people and all these terrible, terrible people? And you have nothing to say about that. There's nothing you can do. And then to recognize, wait a minute, you know, if it's how I'm seeing it, if it's how I'm responding to it for whatever reason, that means that I can do something about this. That's empowerment.
If you're playing a role, you can change your role.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
This is a lot of stuff. You've got something for listeners. Tell us a little bit about what you have and how they might be able to access that.
Well, Lee, I start off all of my private sessions with clients with a particular tool that I'm offering to your listeners today as a free gift. And it's a guided breathing exercise. It's about 9 minutes of audio. And I've also attached to that a PDF so that they'll know they're getting it right. And so eventually they'll just learn it on their own and they'll practice these breathing exercises. You know, in 2015, there was a study done that showed that just 10 seconds of controlled, conscious, intentional breathing will flip a person's system from fight or flight into calm. Just 10 seconds. And so these are quick little things. And I coach my clients to practice them in the morning and the evening for 5 minutes each, just to condition the nervous system, to condition it to realize that it can feel a different way. I mean, remember, I referenced 40 million Americans with anxiety. I mean, that's primarily what I see these days. Lots of times it's because of trauma, but used to be depression. Now it's more anxiety. And this just makes such a huge difference. And clients will come back and say, oh, I just, you know, I used that, you know, the ocean wave breathing, you know, or I did the, you know, earth-centered breathing, and it just made all the difference. So there's three different breath works, and they each have their own purpose. And I put that in the PDF so they know what they're doing, and in the guided part as well. And if they just go to brainscienceofstress.com. brainscienceofstress.com, and they'll get the a link for the downloadable recording in the PDF.
Okay. And so just, and when we say PDF, that means it's a document.
Yeah. Sorry about that. Yeah.
No, I mean, it's, we say it so quickly, but a PDF is read by a PDF reader, but it's actually a document, ebook or brochure or whatever.
And this, it's just a handout.
Yeah. Yes. So you could look at that and read the instructions as well as listening to the instructions.
Thank you for helping me be literate.
Sometimes people go PDF, you know, they've got a PDF. How do you spell that? Yeah, literally, P-D and an F, but it's just a format for a file. So brainscienceofstress.com is where you locate those resources.
Yes.
Davis, thank you so much for sharing that.
Absolutely.
Having a way of finding calm through your breath is a great way of starting this process, because finding that calm is the beginning point. So thanks again. Also, I just wanted to mention, you have a book called The Image Maker. Mm-hmm. The subtitle is Transforming Life from the Inside Out. And that's also trying to get beyond that junk to the core piece. So
Absolutely. It's available on Amazon.
So if this has hit a nerve, start out at brainscienceofstress.com and also look for the book, The Image Maker, at amazon.com, and you'll be on your way.
Yes, thank you. Thanks so much.
Listening to the Thriveology podcast. Thank you for listening. If you want more information, visit us at thriveology.com or at thriveologymagazine.com. Remember that Thriveology is spelled Thriveology. It's your life. Time to live it.